Just as our balance sheet represents the collective financial strength of our members, our spring meetings next week represent our collective commitment to cooperation and international dialogue.
Welcome to the IMF podcast. In this episode, IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva kicks off the 2024 IMF World Bank Spring Meetings from the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C., where she delivers her customary curtain-raiser speech.
Like the IMF, the Council is an institution grounded in the belief that dialogue and cooperation can build a more prosperous world. We also share some DNA. Secretary Dean Acheson, who co-founded the Atlantic Council, was also present at the Bretton Woods conference that Fred referred to in 1944, which gave birth to the IMF and the World Bank. Reflecting on his years in public service, Acheson later wrote, "The simple truth is that perseverance in good policies is the only avenue for success. In a world of more frequent shocks and heightened uncertainty, we need good policies more than ever. Making the right policy choices will define the future of the world economy. It will define how this decade is remembered. Will it go down in history as the turbulent 20s, a time of disruptance and divergence in economic fortunes, or the tepid 20s, a time of slow growth and popular discontent, or the transformational 20s, a time of rapid technological advancements for the good of humanity?" Well, we will talk about these questions, but before I go there, let me start with where we are today. You will see in our World Economic Outlook next week that global growth is marginally stronger on account of robust activity in the United States and in a number of emerging market economies. Sustained household consumption and business investment and an easing of supply chain problems helped. And inflation is going down. The resilience of the world economy, mostly due to the sound macroeconomic fundamentals, the good policies that Acheson talks about, that we built over the last years, this resilience is helped by strong labor markets and an expanding labor force. The strength of labor supply is partially due to immigration, which has been especially helpful in countries with aging populations. Overall, based on the data, it is tempting to breathe a sigh of relief. We have avoided the global recession and a period of stagflation. Some have predicted it. It has not happened. But there are still plenty of things to worry about. The global environment has become more challenging. Geopolitical tensions increase the risk of fragmentation of the world economy. And as we have learned in the past few years, we operate in a world in which we must expect the unexpected. The sobering reality is global economic activity is weak by historical standards. Prospects for growth have been slowing since the global financial crisis. Just look at this graph. And inflation is not fully defeated. Fiscal buffers, on the other hand, have been depleted, and debt is up, posing a major challenge to public finances in many countries. The scars of the pandemics are still with us. The global output loss since 2020 is around $3.3 trillion, with the costs disproportionately falling on the most vulnerable countries. And we see a growing divergence within and across country groups. Among advanced economies, the US has experienced the strongest rebound, helped by rising productivity growth. By contrast, activity in the euro area is recovering much more gradually, reflecting the lingering effects of high energy prices and weaker productivity growth. Among emerging market economies, countries like Indonesia and India are faring better, but there are some in vulnerable situation. And what is most striking is divergence for low-income countries, for whom the scarring has been the most severe. Among these nations, fragile and conflict-affected economies are bearing the heaviest burden. Beneath it all, the primary driver of weaker growth is a significant and broad-based slowdown in productivity. Our analysis shows it accounts for over half of the growth slowdown in advanced and emerging economies, and nearly all in low-income countries. As a result, our medium-term outlook for global growth remains well below its historical average. It is just slightly above 3%. Without a course correction, we are indeed heading for the tepid 20s. A sluggish and disappointing decade. And at this junction, policymakers face a choice. They can avoid difficult decisions and try to muddle through with less than good policies. Or they can make another choice. They can follow Acheson's advice and choose good policies, deal decisively with inflation and debt, and promote economic transformation to boost productivity, inclusion, and sustainable growth. What we need is the transformational 20s. But first things first. First, we need to bring back price stability. This is the task of central bankers, many of whom are carefully calibrating this important policy choice. When to cut interest rates and by how much? We have seen what good policies can achieve since inflation peaked in mid-2022. In the final quarter of 2023, headline inflation for advanced economies was 2.3%, down from 9.5% just 18 months earlier. For the median emerging market and developing economy, inflation declined to 4.1%. And we expect this trend to continue in 2024. But let me say, continue with ups and downs, backs and forths. Creating the conditions for major advanced economy central banks to begin cutting rates in the second half of the year. And the pace and timing, we have to be very clear, this monetary pivot would differ from a country to a country. No more we are in the place of the 2020 when everybody went in the same direction. Central banks will have to carefully monitor data. Some have already begun to loosen. These are mostly central banks in emerging markets where inflation was tackled earlier. But elsewhere, primarily in advanced economies, they are still holding off on cutting for now. And they will calibrate what to do based on incoming data. On this final stretch, it is doubly important that central banks uphold their independence. As we know, policy credibility is vital in the fight to restore price stability. Where necessary, policymakers must resist calls for premature interest rate cuts. Because premature easing can see new inflation surprises that may even necessitate a further bout of monetary tightening. And we have to recognize on the other side, delaying too long could pour cold water on economic activity. Let me go to our second priority. Time has come to rebuild fiscal buffers. Over the past couple of years, we at the Fund have been advocating for fiscal policy restraint, primarily to support central banks as they fight inflation. But now, a focus on fiscal policy is warranted on its own right. Why? Because fiscal buffers are exhausted and debt levels in most countries are simply too high. The trend of rising debts actually began more than a decade ago, during a prolonged period of very low interest rates. The pandemic then necessitated an unprecedented fiscal response to protect lives and livelihoods, and then debt surged even more. Now we are in an era of far higher interest rates, and this is pushing the cost of servicing debt up. In advanced economies, excluding the United States, interest payments on public debt will average at about 5% of government revenues this year. But the cost of servicing debt is most painful in low-income countries. Their interest payments are set to average about 14% of government revenue, roughly double the level from 15 years ago. Now, for most countries, the prospect of soft landing and strong labor markets mean there is no better time to act. To reach sustainable debt levels and build stronger buffers to cope with the shocks that will come in the future. For some countries, delay is simply not an option. Consolidation must start now to avoid tipping into debt distress. And for a handful of countries already in debt distress, restructuring may be a necessity. And there, the common framework that the G20 put together can help. I want to celebrate with all of you Zambia's achievement. They recently finalized its agreement with the bondholders, complementing the restructuring with official bilateral creditors. So, bravo! But there are more countries that need to get to the same point. Now, we have learned lessons from the debt restructuring processes, and we need to build on these lessons. And I want to stress that this would be a big part of discussions during our spring meetings. We will convene again the Global Sovereign Debt Roundtable, and our goal this time would be to build further clarity on comparability of treatment among different creditor groups and to establish clear and predictable timelines for debt restructuring. Now, for all countries, rich and poor, fiscal prudence is hard. And this is especially true in a year with a record number of elections and at the time of high anxiety due to exceptional uncertainty and all these years of shocks. In fact, our forecasts show deficits will still be too high to stabilize debt in over one-third of advanced and emerging economies and in more than one-quarter of low-income countries. And this is why we are advocating for adopting a credible medium-term fiscal framework as the ultimate good policy choice for countries. And we also recommend more focus on closing tax loopholes, strengthening tax collection, improving the quality of public services. Fiscal strength allows countries to support the most vulnerable parts of their societies and to invest in a better future. And that brings me to the third priority, policies to reinvigorate growth. Lifting up growth prospects is paramount. We know it. Without it, we can't see living standards going up. We can't strengthen economic resilience. What it requires are two things: eliminating constraints to economic activity and creating opportunities to boost productivity growth. foundational reforms, strengthening governance, cutting red tape, increasing female labor market participation, improving access to capital, they all have a role to play. Across emerging and developing countries, a well-sequenced package of reforms of that nature could lift output by 8% in 4 years. And of course, even more can be achieved with policies to encourage economic transformation, to speed up the green and digital transition. How well we handle them will define the legacy of this decade. And this is particularly important for the green transition. How quickly we advance it will have tremendous significance to whether we succeed to tame climate risks. But the shift to a climate-friendly economy goes beyond managing risks. It also offers tremendous opportunities for investments, for jobs and growth. And we are already witnessing the economic, health and environmental benefits of transformative investments, including in renewable energy, in electric mobility. I see Jeffrey Okamoto here. Jeffrey, I hope you're still driving your Tesla, or your Tesla is driving you. And in ecosystems restoration. For every $1 spent on fossil fuels, $1.7 now is spent on clean energy. 5 years ago, this ratio was 1-to-1. But we need robust policies and institutions for a stable and encouraging, predictable investments in climate, also to tackle a range of market failures. I mean, obviously, technological advancements go way beyond what I just listed. They affect many sectors of the economy, from manufacturing to healthcare and financial services. We have been transitioning to a new digital economy, and the pandemic put it on steroids. And now artificial intelligence is likely to dramatically accelerate the fourth industrial revolution. This brings huge potential benefits, but also risks. A recent IMF study shows that artificial intelligence could affect up to 40% of jobs across the world and 60% in advanced economies. It could enhance workers' productivity, but also threatens some jobs. Investing in digital infrastructure and skills, as well as in strong social safety nets, will determine the pace of AI adoption and its impact on productivity. Both the climate and the digital transformation require coordinated global efforts to manage risks and capture the benefits they create. And that takes me to my final point. Cooperation on policies matters to the world. The pandemic, war, geopolitical tensions, they have already changed the playbook for global economic relations. Policymakers are looking to strike a balance between efficiency and security, between cost considerations and resilience of supply chains. There are already signs that trade relations are being reshaped. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, trade growth between economies in politically distant blocs has slowed by 2.4 percentage points more than trade among those that are more closely aligned. And as trade flows are rerouted, connected countries may benefit. But supply chains are lengthening with potential costs at every step. And industrial policies are back on the agenda, with new analysis showing more than 2,500 policy interventions worldwide just last year. China, the EU, and US account for almost half of the total. How should we think about these measures? In short, if there is a market failure that needs to be addressed, such as accelerating innovation to address the existential threat of climate change, there is a case for government intervention, including through industrial policy. If there is no market failure, there is a need for caution. The case for government intervention is much weaker. Some of the measures announced or implemented last year were not always clearly related to market failures. Our staff has stepped up working this area because more data analysis and dialogue are needed to avoid costly mistakes. More broadly, we advocate for more trade and cross-border investment flows to increase productivity and address global challenges, and for more attention for how the benefits from trade and investment are shared in society. We must avoid past mistakes when the negative impact of globalization on some community was ignored and led to backlash against an integrated world economy. So let me say a couple of words about us, the IMF. Throughout our history, we have been and we remain a transmission line for good policies and a place for economic cooperation. In a fast-changing and more turbulent world, bringing countries together to tackle challenges and pursue opportunities is more important than it has ever been. When the world has been hit by the pandemic and a cost of a living crisis, as Fred said, we acted decisively to help our members. We have also stepped up our efforts to help countries deal with transformational challenges such as climate change and the digital transition with new analysis, with new partnerships, with new instruments. For example, we now have the Resilience and Sustainability Trust. It provides already support to 18 countries. And just as countries build resilience to shocks, so do we at the IMF. Our numbers in terms of financial strength are going up, and rightly so. Our members have supported 50% quarter increase for our permanent lending resources and more capacity to help our poorest members. We have reached our target for our own financial buffer. So when we send to countries, build financial buffers, we do it ourselves. And now we are directing our attention to how better we could use our balance sheet to ensure we are well positioned to help our members. And that is a good place to end. Just as our balance sheet represents the collective financial strength of our members, our spring meetings next week represent our collective commitment to cooperation and international dialogue. So, as we gather in Washington, we have what Acheson described as a fundamental choice between meeting the problems with which the world will be faced through methods of international cooperation or each nation's relying on its own resources and its own strength and going its own way. Working together is the choice of good policies, the choice that would deliver what we aspire for: growth, jobs, and prosperity for people everywhere. Thank you.
IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva with the 2024 Spring Meetings curtain raiser speech from the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Go to imf.org to follow the meetings and find all the flagship reports, including the World Economic Outlook, the Global Financial Stability Report, and the Fiscal Monitor. And look for more IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.